Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of season 11 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off his stint but start off the week is Sam Edwards, an associate professor at Loughborough University. Welcome back to the show once again, Sam.
Fantastic to be back, Rob. Looking forward to having another good talk.
Yes, me too. And we have to first start off with some unfinished business from Friday. Okay. We were talking about Harris, and we were wondering what happened to Harris after he was... I got in touch over the weekend with George Luz, and he sent me a quite a long link that gives information about what happened to PFC Terrence Salty Harris. Okay, so Harris, what's interesting is that the miniseries makes it seem as if he's being thrown out of the entire regiment, but he actually wasn't. He was just moved to Baker Company. Okay. He was taken out of Easy. That's the whole idea. What he ended up doing was, because of the fact that, he got into this trouble with the mutiny that we talked about yesterday. So he was demoted back to private and then transferred to another company within the regiment. Okay. He was transferred to Baker Company, and there he joined the Pathfinder team, which was led by First Lieutenant Roy Kessler. And on D-Day morning, Team C was scheduled to land at the drop zone C, and they dropped at 27 minutes after midnight, and they came under fire from the enemy. He actually managed to survive the fighting on D-Day, but he was killed in action at the very beginning of the battle for Carentan. He was killed by sniper fire, and the report says that he was killed on June 18th, which again is a little less than 2 weeks after the landing on D-Day, but they actually believe that he was killed sometime between June 10th and the 14th, but they only found his body on the 18th.
So sad.
So. Unfortunately, the questions we raised yesterday about Harris were for naught, because unfortunately, he didn't make it further into the war, and obviously didn't make it out of the war. He is buried in Normandy. He was in in the temporary military cemetery in Sainte Marie Église. And then he was eventually moved to the American cemetery in
which
Normandy.
Is such a moving place.
Well, if you ever go back, I have the exact area where his plot is. If you want to go, pay your respects.
That'd be interesting to know. Assault. Yeah, because I will be going back at some point.
Okay, I'll send you the link that I have here with the information. So yes, you see, that's one of the great things about doing this one day at a time, that I can. Between days, I can theoretically get information, from the encyclopedic source of George Luz Jr. So it's very interesting when questions like that come up. It's not even questions about the miniseries itself. It's questions about the men. Those are the things that I could that I can get information on. So okay, we closed up the unfinished business from yesterday. Episode 11 begins with Winters showing that he's pretty proud, and ends with Winters talking to Compton about his actions.
Yep.
So we ended things on Friday. The NCOs basically all getting a reprimand from Sink, and they come out of his office, and they pass by Winters, who's on mess patrol. And Winters is able to spot them, and he appreciates what they tried doing, even though, according to the book, it's not. He didn't recommend that they do what they did, because they were taking a very big risk. But none of them got shot for mutiny. So I guess in the end, that paid off from that perspective. So we get a few seconds of the camera lingering on Winters, and we see that Winters, he's yes. proud of what his men have done. You can see it on his face. You know, even though it was a very gutsy move and it was something he didn't recommend because of the potential consequences, I guess the fact that he saw that they're all walking out and not being let out in leg irons and handcuffs, that it went relatively yeah. well. Let's put it that way. I mean, even though we know that that Rainey and Harris both got reprimands more so than the rest, but you know, the rest of them still managed to retain their ranks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then the shot changes, and we actually spend most of this 5-minute segment with Sobel and Sink having a very interesting yes, conversation yes. here. So, I mean, we can tell from everything that happened in Friday's episode that Sink knows he has a problem here and has to figure out a way to diplomatically yeah. get out of it. You know, he doesn't want to automatically demote Sobel for this whole thing, because you need to you know, as we discussed on Friday, that he's still standing together with Sobel from an adversarial perspective.
Yeah, he's going to show the troops. There's a consequence, right? Yeah,
that's right. But he still needs to find a way to deal with this situation, because I'm assuming that Sink realizes that they have a big problem here. These men, you know, if all their NCOs are willing to quote unquote put their lives on the line to get out of serving with him, you know, that's already a big thing. So, you know, we got to deal something with this. And I'm assuming that Sink did a little bit more research at this point to realize that as good of a commander as Sobel might be, yeah. he's not a good leader. And therefore he decided, okay, let's see what we can do with him in order to appease him, but also change yes. the situation a little bit. So it starts off with Sobel sitting in a chair, and he goes, "I can only speculate, sir. Most of the men would never do this, but I believe just a few of the sergeants may have felt their loyalty lay more to the platoon than to the company." So first of all, Sobel is completely, lying to himself, mm-hmm. if that's the idea here. You know, what does it have to do with them, you know, being loyal to the platoon
yeah.
as opposed to the company? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know, his comment is complete gibberish from that perspective.
Yeah, you get a sense of him trying to get his way out of this.
Exactly. Yeah, but again, they're all saying they don't want to serve under Sobel. So how is that, you know, showing yeah. loyalty to the platoon? I mean, we know that there is the issue here that Sobel is very jealous of what the men think of Winters, that they don't think the same way of him. And Winters is the platoon commander at the time. I mean, he's also the XO, but still. And then Sink says to him, "And these few sergeants convince all the other NCOs in your company to turn in their stripes?" So again, you know, it's not as if the NCOs, all the sergeants, are just in one particular mm-hmm. platoon. You know, these are guys in all three platoons that are saying, okay, we don't want to serve with Sobel. So that in itself throws away the whole idea that they have loyalty to their platoon, because again, it's loyalty to the other people in the company, that even if they're right. in other platoons. So again, it really makes no sense what his logic is. And then Sobel goes, "Well, as staff sergeants, they have influence, sir. But as I say, the rest are good men. I know them. I can work with them." And Sink isn't really buying it.
No.
You know, you can see on his face. He's like, okay, you are totally grasping for straws here. You know, I mean, it is noble of Sobel to try to defend the rest of the sergeants there, but still, you know, they still
yes.
don't want to serve with him. You know, but I think he's more concerned with him saving face and, you know, keeping his command.
I think that's exactly it. Yeah.
You know, that's what Sobel's concerned about. And as Sink is talking, he goes over to the desk and he picks up a bottle of booze and starts pouring a drink. And then he looks over at Strayer, who's also in the room. And then he looks at him and goes, he looks at Sobel. And then he says, "This business with Winter's court-martial has been an unpleasant distraction." And Sobel goes, "Indeed, Indeed it has, sir. He goes, however, and then the booze into a glass, and he goes, your command of Easy Company has been exemplary. Thank you, sir. In fact, except for the actions of a few of your non-coms, I believe you fielded one of the finest companies of soldiers I've ever seen. Yes, sir. And at this point, he gives Sobel a drink. You know, he gives him a drink, and Sobel then takes the drink really quickly, and he starts drinking it, but you can see that he's drinking it. He feels very uneasy during this, during the way that he's drinking.
Yep.
So it's interesting, the whole thing. Again, we've talked about this before. Sobel is an amazing instructor. He might not have the best methods of how he's doing it, but the results are just unbelievable. I mean, there's no refuting the fact that he did a great job, you know.
Yes.
Instructing these men. He's just a really, really bad leader. That's what it comes down to.
And I think this comes through, as you say, in this scene, which I think is a really well-crafted scene. And what comes through from Colonel Sink is that there is some genuine respect there for Sobel in terms of the caliber and the quality of the company that he's trained. You get a sense of that's when he offers that praise to Sobel. He's not just blowing smoke up his ass. He is there's a no. genuine quality to it. It's authentic, but at the same time, you get a nice kind of building sense of what's about to happen. That there's a degree of flattery being laid down here. There's a bit of a, what we'd call in a kind of in the education profession, a bit of a sandwich going on here. He's kind of building him up. He's giving him some praise, but partly because what's going to happen immediately after that praise is the chop. And that's what we see happen in this scene.
Yeah. But Sink is thinking about things from many different perspectives. And one of the perspectives is, okay, I have a problem. You know, it's the same problem that any manager or, dean or a department head or, you know, whatever field you want to try and relate it to, anyone who's in charge of other people, they have to look around and try and figure out, okay, how can I use the men or the people that I have under me in the most efficient way? Yes. And he's saying, okay, I have a big problem here that the men don't respect Sobel enough in order to have him lead them into combat. So, all right, let's look at what Sobel is good at. Sobel is an amazing instructor. So, all right, I'm going to flatter him a little bit, but I think that Sink still believes it. You know, he's as you said, he's not just blowing smoke up his ass. He's saying to him, you know, I really do appreciate the type of work that you did as an instructor. And I mean, as we're going to get into the rest of the scene, you know, he's saying, okay, I'm going to now use that. He's saying it to himself. Sink is saying, I'm going to use that to my advantage.
Yes.
You know, there are things that you're bad at and there are things that you're good at. So let's take the things that you're not even just good at, you're great at. And let's try and use that to make the army and everything better.
Yes. Yeah, this is Colonel Sink trying to resolve the situation whilst also finding a role which will enable Sobel to demonstrate his excellence, to use his skills, to do what he's good at.
Yes. Exactly. You know, so again, he is flattering him, but it's truthful and believable flattery.
Yes, it is.
What he's saying.
Yeah.
And then so Sobel then agrees with him and goes, yes, sir. And then he goes, Herbert, the Vision has established a parachute training school at Chilton Foliat.
Yep.
Now, do you know where that is?
Not exactly. I think it's in Wiltshire. I think it's in the same county. It's in the southwest of England, that kind of area.
Ah, okay. And then Sink continues and says, the idea is for non-infantry types who were vital to the coming invasion, such as doctors and chaplains, big jump training there. Frankly, I can't think of anyone more qualified to command such a school than you are. And Sobel is in complete shock by this line of what he's saying to him. You know, he hasn't taken it all in yet, but he, you know, and it's quite interesting because he is giving him a promotion here.
Yes.
You know, but the promotion, like, if you think about it, he's getting this promotion because his men hate him. But on the other hand, he's getting this promotion because since his men hate him, let's find something that he's great at, and he's great at as an instructor. So let's give him that job.
Yeah,
you know, that's a. So I like the logic here.
Yes,
because it's okay. Let's do what's best for the army, and you know, and at the same time, let's do what's best for the not just the company but the regiment.
Yes. Yep.
You know, Yeah, because I can't move Sobel into a different company within the nine companies that we have. So let's move him to somewhere where people aren't going to know him. And, you know, even if they theoretically begin to hate him, what he's doing is he's there to train them, yes, not to lead them into battle or anything like that.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, what comes through is that whilst it is a promotion, Sobel seems to perceive it as a demotion, that he's having the company taken away from him. And you get a sense then of kind of the perceptions, the hierarchies of command, which aren't just about rank, but also about role, and for Sobel and for others, because it happens again later in the series around when Winters is on his journey up the chain of command, that being a combat leader and being in charge of a company, there's a real kind of attachment to that for many officers, real sense of kind of prestige and purpose with that role. And what comes through in this scene is Sobel realizing that important role is being taken from him.
Right, exactly. And so Sobel just looks at Sink and goes, "Sir?" And he goes, "I'm reassigning you to Chilton Foliat." And he does a double take, and then Sobel says, "I'm losing easy company." So, and you know, it shows that he does also have a connection to easy company.
Yes.
It's possible that what he likes is the way he's being able to command the men. I mean, it could be just a power struggle for him. He's good at being this mean commander who, you know, gets the most out of his men, even if he doesn't do it in the right way.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. And he's now going to be losing that.
Yes.
And I there's also from the perspective that, you know, you know, you can look at it that, okay, he's in an infantry perspective position right now, and they're moving him to a non-combat position. You know, he might be scared, and you know, when we've seen him getting ready for the jumps, you know, he was scared. When we see him on maneuvers, he's scared. He doesn't know what he's doing, but he still has inside of him the desire to be able to lead men in combat. Yes. And here they're saying to him, okay, instead of leading combat, we're now going to go send you to be a commander of a jump school for doctors and chaplains.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing.
And what you get here is a real sense that Sobel, like everyone, is aware that not only has he been kind of involved in training Easy for combat, but he's been involved in training them for combat for what Sink himself has said is that, you know, it's the upcoming greatest endeavor in the history of warfare. So there's a real sense of, you know, I was in charge of a company, something meaningful, something purposeful. I was going to lead them into combat, and all of that is now gone because I've been, inverted commas, promoted to this other role. But I won't get to do any of those things that I've been kind of envisaging and planning for.
Right. Exactly. And you know, the music here is great. Also, you can start hearing the music as Sobel comes to the realization, you know, that he's losing his company.
Yes.
Type of thing. You know, it adds a little more emotion to that particular moment of going through there.
It does, and I think the whole scene is so beautifully crafted. Like when you look at it, you've got the roaring fire in the background, and you've got Colonel Sink over by his desk, and there's another officer in the room, and Sobel's there, sat in a chair. And the chair's really low. There's almost something about, like, so he seems quite low into the chair, and there's all the kind of the power relationship that comes through in terms of the positioning, the figures. There's almost something a bit like Sobel as schoolboy in the principal's office here, being kind of, you know, corrected. It's a really well-crafted and well-structured scene, I think.
Yeah, but, I mean, you also get the point that if it was a schoolboy, the schoolboy wouldn't be promoted.
No.
that's a slight problem there, but yeah. And then Sink says to him, "Well, the war effort needs you elsewhere."
Yeah.
And then Strayer goes over and opens the door, meaning, okay, we're done here. Get out.
Yeah, there's that wonderful bit where Sink just kind of glances to make it clear that, yeah, he wants the door open and this meeting's coming to a close. Yeah.
That's right. And then Sobel gets up, and as he's getting up, he says, "Permission to speak, sir?" And he goes, "Granted." He goes, who will be replacing me? Now, I have no doubt in my mind that what is going through Sobel's mind right now is that Winters is the one who's going to be taking over for me.
Yeah.
That's his fear right now.
Yeah.
you know, that they've gotten rid of me and they're going to put my quote unquote arch enemy in my place.
Yeah.
And I mean, Sync is not that stupid.
No. He's really skillful, isn't it? Yeah, that he's Sobel is expecting Sync to say, you know, Lieutenant Winters is taking over, but he does. Then it's Meehan, and in doing so, Sync avoids any suggestion that he is favoring and Winters over Sobel. Yeah, it's 100.
Exactly. Right, and then he goes, "Well, Lieutenant Meehan from Baker Company is senior," and then he goes, "Good luck to Chilton Foley at Herbert. Don't let us down." So it's like. He gives him a swift answer and basically gives him a kick in the ass and says, get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. Good luck. Have fun. You know, don't let us down. And he goes, no, sir.
It's a good scene. Yeah. And the great Dale Dyer as Colonel Sync here. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I do like the fact that Sobel and Sync shake hands. And then after they shake hands, Sobel then salutes him.
Yes.
You know, showing that, okay, this is a friendly... sort of off the record conversation, but we still have to stand by military protocol.
Absolutely.
With everything that we're doing.
Respectful.
You know, I like.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And then at this point, Sobel leaves the office, and we see that the Strayer begins to close the door, and the shot changes. So at this point, then we see Sobel getting into a Jeep, being driven out of this little town. And, you know, he passes by Winters, and Winters then salutes him. And Sobel completely ignores him. And I like the fact that they show this, because this will come back to us much later on about the fact that, you know, you salute exactly, the rank, not the man.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing. And Winters shows how much he is going to go along with military protocol with these type of things. You know, he doesn't necessarily like Sobel, but he will still
kind of an example.
You know, you have the rank.
Yeah, Winter's kind of sense of duty, his sense of decency as well. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then the shot changes, and we see it says it's May 31st, 1944, a Pottery, England. And then we see a whole bunch of men coming out of some trucks. And it's a large staging area with a lot of tents and a lot of men. And then we get to see Buck Compton for the first time. And he goes, second platoon, listen up. I want the first squad and A-side tents right up there. Third squad, second row. You know, he's giving out instructions on how to set everything up and stuff like that. And the men all start, just chattering all around them as they're taking care of this whole thing. And then we see three Germans basically walking towards them, and Hubler's there, and he goes, holy, and then the one of the Germans starts talking to him in a very, very deep, I guess, Cockney accent, and he says, no, it's all right, mate, we're Tommies, and he goes, not bleeding, Bosch. And he says, all this really is, yeah, well, some of it's from the Hermans that someone's tailor knocked up. For you, and then knocked up for you lads, so you can get your mince pies on some of these Jerry Clobber, if you know what I mean. On some of this Jerry Clobber, if you know what I mean. Now, I have no idea what he really means either, you know, because Hubler says not really, because he's talking colloquially. No question about that.
Yeah, this is Cockney rhyming slang. So mince pies is eyes. Get your eyes on this, and Clobber is clothes, is kit. So yeah, and I love this scene, because in about a couple of minutes, it captures something that was absolutely at the heart of the World War II friendly invasion of the Yanks in England during World War II, and that was the extent to which we share a common language, but at times we're divided by that common language. There's a great writer from the late 19th century, George Bernard Shaw, early 20th century, George Bernard Shaw, who famously said, Americans and Britons are two great people separated by a common language. And what comes through in this scene is just that. They kind of get each other, and they can communicate, but each is using language and dialect and terms and slang, which at times just goes straight over the head of the other person. So it's beautifully done, I think, this bit.
Yes. Yeah. And thank you for translating what you were saying. See, I knew there was a reason that I wanted you on these scenes.
There you go.
And so Hubler then answers, goes, well, not really. And the Brit goes, eh. And then Hoover just changes the subject. He goes, hey, man, you got a Luger? I'm dying to get my hands on a real Luger. And he goes, yeah, go on then. Quick butchers, yeah?
Yep.
And Hoover takes the gun. And again, this is foreshadowing for, I believe it's in the seventh part of the whole thing about how much Hoover really, really wants a Luger.
He wants a Luger, yep.
Yeah. And he goes, boy, she sure is a doozy. And he goes, yeah, it's Pucker, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's a beautiful moment, right? So you got there's a perfect example. You got each of them is calling the Luger by a slang term which makes sense in either American English or British English. So it's either a doozy or it's Pucker. Word means the same pretty much, but at the same time completely different.
Right. And then Hoover just looks at him and goes, what? And he goes, eh. And then Hoover starts walking away with the now I gotta say I give a lot of credit to the actor who's playing the British soldier dressed in German uniform here, because before he gives him the Luger, he does check the chamber to make sure there's no bullet there, pulls out the
yeah.
You know, he does a very nice job of safely handing over this Luger so that nothing accidentally happens.
Absolutely.
Which I think also is a little bit of foreshadowing for later. I believe so. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But it might be unintended. But it definitely is foreshadowing.
I think you're right.
And at this point, Hoover then starts walking away and screams, "Hey, Petty!" And you know he's walking away with the Luger, and the British guy goes, "Hey, mate, you having a bath? If you think you're half inch in that." Okay. Yep. Now I understand that half inching must mean stealing that. I don't know what it means. You're having a bath. It probably means you're out of your mind, or you must be joking.
It's exactly that. So yeah, again, it's Cockney rhyming slang. So you're having a bath is you're having a laugh, as in you're having a laugh if you think that's okay. And the inching bit is a rhyming slang on pinching. So you're having a laugh if you're pinching that. You're taking the mick out of me if you're going to take that from me. Yeah.
Right. But again, it goes back to what you said. Hoover doesn't understand him, but still understands him. And he goes, oh yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
And give him back the gun, and he goes, hey, good luck. And he goes, you too, mate. And then he gets up to Petty, and Petty goes, what's up, Hoobs? And, you know, he doesn't really – we don't need to have him reiterate everything that just happened. But it's still a great moment, the way that they show this you know, these characters together for this whole thing. You
know, absolutely. I completely agree. Yes, sir. It's a kind of a wonderful moment of – Yanks meet Brits, or Yanks meet Limeys in the lingo of the moment, and it all happens in that kind of broader context of them kind of readying for the invasion. So yeah, they're shifting to an encampment, and also you just get a little bit of a hint here as well of the detail that's gone into the preparation in the weeks and months before D-Day. So here you got as you say, three Brits in German uniform, because clearly they've been role playing the enemy in the training exercises that have been underway for the past few weeks. So whole lot going on in this scene. It's well handled.
You think they're in training exercises that way, or are they in a unit that's training similar to what they did in the Battle of the Bulge? You know, the Germans, what they did, they had, you know, Germans who spoke American. Who spoke English perfectly that were pretending to be English, that were pretending to be Americans. Is it possible? I mean, do you think there were British units, or do you know if there were British units that did the same type of thing for infiltration purposes?
Not to my knowledge, at least not in the same way as you described there, as we know that happens with Wehrmacht infiltrators during the Battle of Bulge, where English-speaking Germans are uniformed up as Americans to kind of infiltrate and to disrupt. To my knowledge, it doesn't happen like that in Normandy in terms of the Allies trying to do likewise. And given what we've just learned of the characters there, and the fact that one of them is kind of talking in broad Cockney, I'm going to make a sort of an assumption here, but I didn't get a sense there of a potentially fluent German speaker. So my gut is that they're probably being tasked with role playing.
He's a very, very talented linguist, you know, that who's able to just do dialects. There you go.
Well, yeah, what do I know? So maybe that's the case. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I like that. I guess you're right. These guys are just pretending to be the enemy.
Yeah.
So, okay, that works. And then the scene changes, and we see Winters driving in a Jeep with Compton. And Winters is sort of chewing out Compton, and he says, these men have been through the toughest training the Army has to offer under the worst possible circumstances, and they volunteered for it. And he goes, Christ, Dick, I was just shooting craps with them. It's not like, he goes, you know why they volunteered? And Compton doesn't really have an answer for him. And he goes, so when things get really bad, the man in the foxhole next to him would be the best, not some draftee who's going to get him killed. And, you know, tomorrow we'll go more into this conversation between the two of them. But I really like this conversation because, again, it shows, as fair as Winters wants to be with the men, he's, you know, he's constantly looking out for them. You know, he doesn't want anyone doing anything that can put them in a situation where someone's taking advantage of them.
Yes.
And, yeah. You know, there also is the idea of, you know, officers and enlisted men need to keep some sort of separation between them because of the duties of command, where you need to sometimes make decisions and you're not going to necessarily make the right decision if you're thinking of someone as my friend, as opposed to this is the best soldier for this particular mission or whatever.
Exactly. This is Winter's clearly setting his expectations around what good leadership looks like. This is him sort of setting his expectations to Compton and making that point that at the end of the day, you're commanding these guys. You're not their friend, and you need to find a way to draw some lines, because we're going into a situation where you're going to have to make difficult decisions about their lives, and there needs to be a line between you and them to enable you to do that, and so that they have a clear sense of what your obligations are, what your responsibility is to them, what your job is in this whole thing.
Exactly. Excellent. And that's the way this particular segment ends. You know, people are going to have to come back tomorrow to hear the rest of the conversation between Dick and Buck. But so, Sam, do you have anything else you want to say in general about Band of Brothers or about this 5-minute segment that we just discussed?
I guess just one more thing about kind of in general the series, and we've kind of touched on this at various points in our conversation, but just to reiterate here, how impressive I think this series is. You think about all the various television shows that have existed over the last, you know, half century or so, dealing with the subject of the Second World War, and this has got to be up there with the very best, if not the very best. And certainly when you put it in the context of the three series which Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks have been involved in telling the story of the Second World War, with Band of Brothers, The Pacific, and then most recently 2024's Masters of the Air. They're all great in various ways, but I think the first of them, Band of Brothers, this one, is still head and shoulders above the other two in terms of the characters, in terms of the story arc that the series works through in its episodes, and even in terms of things like, you know, the kind of the scenes, the way each episode is filmed, even in terms as well of the music, of the score, which is outstanding throughout. So just that's my final word. This is a great series. I'm guessing that people are listening to this have watched it already, but if you haven't, absolutely watch it.
Exactly. Totally agree with you on that. All right, so we will now play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie.
Okay. Where,
I will randomly give you clues about a World War II movie, and you have to try and guess what movie we're talking about. So let's spin the wheel and see where it goes. Round and round and round the wheel goes. Okay. This is a TV miniseries from 1983.
Okay.
Which discusses what happens to two families during the early years of World War II.
Okay. Is it Winds of War?
Yes, it is.
Hey.
You see on Friday you had a trivia question from the Winds of War, and now you get the actual miniseries. You're awesome. So it once again shows how random this all is, and sometimes randomness brings us back full circle.
Well said, Rob. Absolutely.
Yes, it really is. And you didn't even have to look behind you to see what it was called.
I didn't. It was just there in my head. Yeah.
Well, you remember from Friday. You know,
I did. There was a little bit of a memory kicking in there, yeah.
That's good. I'm glad the memory still works there. Excellent. All right. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Sam Edwards?
So you can find me online at my website, which is www.runninghistorian.co.uk. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Substack as the Running Historian. And if you chuck my name, Sam Edwards, and Loughborough University into Google, you can find me there as well.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So Sam, thank you very much for joining me today and the 2 days last week. And I look forward to having you back that we can talk in general about Band of Brothers and its connection to the real story of the fighting during World War II in Normandy. I look forward to that.
I would like that and look forward to it as well.
Excellent. All right, so I'll be back tomorrow with another guest. Until then, Kurahi!
Kurahi!